What's better in life than a bottle of wine, great food, and an amazing conversation?
My name is Kate Sullivan, and I am the host of To Dine For.
I'm a journalist, a foodie, a traveler with an appetite for the stories of people who are hungry for more. Dreamers, visionaries, artists, those who hustle hard in the direction they love. I travel with them to their favorite restaurant to hear how they did it. This show is a toast to them and their American dream.
To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by Terlato Wine Group and American National Insurance.
To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by Angostura. If you've ever made a cocktail at home, you've most likely shaken Angostura bitters into your cocktail at the very end of the cocktail making process. In addition to bitters, Angostura has been making world-class rum for more than 130 years. The next fall cocktail you make, try the beautiful, smooth flavor of Angostura rum. It will transport you to the Caribbean islands of Trinidad and Tobago. The House of Angostura will celebrate its 200-year anniversary of turning drinks into cocktails in 2024. Cheers, everyone.
To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by American National, offering a broad suite of insurance solutions to protect what matters most to you. For 115 years, American National has remained committed to helping people and communities make a real difference in their lives. American National supports great local community organizations led by the kind of people you hear about on To Dine For. People who are inspired to make a difference and inspire others in return. American National's philosophy is helping where it's needed helps us all. For a description of the American National companies, the products they write, and the states in which they're licensed, visit americannational.com/dine.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dine For, the podcast, where we meet the world's most creative and innovative minds at their favorite restaurant. On today's episode is Adam Braun.
You have to have resiliency, and in some kind of crazy masochistic way, you kind of have to fall in love with the process. You have to fall in love with the journey, knowing that there's going to be both failure and reward. The learnings and the growth comes from the rejection and the failure and the adversity.
Adam Braun is the co-founder and CEO of Clarisite, a company offering carbon planning and analysis software to leading corporations like AstraZeneca and Meta. This platform aids in aligning business goals with sustainability targets. Previously, Braun founded and led Pencils of Promise, an award-winning organization that has established over 600 schools globally. Recognized in Business Insider's 40 Under 40 and Wired Magazine's 50 People Who Are Changing the World, Adam's book, The Promise of a Pencil, became a New York Times bestseller and allowed him to reflect on how small steps can lead to significant change. Please enjoy my conversation with Adam Braun. Adam, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Excellent. Thanks for joining me on this podcast. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Likewise, so am I.
Oh, where are you coming in from?
So I am a little bit more than an hour north of New York City.
In New York, Connecticut? I guess that would be straight New
Connecticut.
York.
Connecticut. Yeah, so previously suburbs of New York, but just recently moved up into Connecticut.
And how's the transition been?
It's been great so far. You know, used to be in the city 5 days a week. Now I'm in less frequently. And just, you know, the access to beautiful nature and great schools for my kids, great public schools was kind of pretty important for my wife and I. So overall, we're really happy, but we're just getting adjusted, but really happy so far.
Do you take the train in?
When I go in, but I go in when I feel like it, which is kind of socially and then a couple times a month for work. But yeah, at this point, I used to love to drive in, but given the distance of like an hour plus, it's just easy to take the train both ways usually.
Good. Well, I'm about an hour west of Chicago and I was in the city for 10 years and we recently moved out as a family, similar, but in different cities to the suburbs. So we are still, it's been 2 years. Yeah. We're still acclimating to suburban life. But well, I am really excited to hear your story, your career trajectory, and obviously to dive into Pencils of Promise. But I'm going to begin this podcast the way I begin all my podcasts, which is to ask your favorite restaurant. If you could take me to one restaurant, whether that happens to be where you live now or in Manhattan or beyond, where would that be?
That's a great question. So I would actually take you to my favorite childhood deli. It's called Rinaldi's Deli. It's in Kaskab in Connecticut. And I grew up not too far from this deli and they just always made anyone that walked in feel like family. And if you ever end up going there, their chicken parm sandwich is unbelievable. And anytime I'm back home, I make sure that I stop by Rinaldi's.
You know what's so funny? Moving to the Midwest, we don't have delis like they exist in New York. I missed a great deli so much for so many different reasons. But it sounds like the reason why you chose Rinaldi's is more than just a great sandwich.
Oh, 100%. It's the nostalgia. You walk in, there's photos all over the walls of different local kids and families. There was a point in time where there's a photo of my mother and I on the wall from a trip that I had taken with her. And yeah, the food is outstanding, but there's a level of warmth and connection to community that is just quite remarkable. And so that's where I would take you.
Awesome. I love that. And is Koskob where you grew up?
Yeah. So I grew up about an hour outside of New York City in Connecticut. And we bounced around a couple different parts of the town that I grew up in, which was Greenwich. But I spent most of my early childhood in a neighborhood, which is Koskob, and played for the Koskob Crushers, the little recreational football team, and spent a lot of time at a little park called Bible Street Park playing basketball. And so, that was a pretty formative part of my upbringing. We moved when I was about four to that area.
And what were the unwritten rules of your family? You know, what were your expectations of your family, and kind of what was the culture? We talk a lot about work culture, but what was the culture of being in your household?
It was unique. You know, I've shared this in a lot of different contexts, but I'll often tell people, I think it's difficult to know where you're going unless you have an understanding of where you come from. And in my case, you know, we had a very closely knit family, but the unwritten rules were very clear, even though they weren't perhaps written. So one of them, which my dad often talks about when I ask him about how he approached parenting my siblings and I, was he held us to a very different standard. And so the way that manifested was almost every single night when he put myself and my older brother and my younger sister to bed, he always would tell us, hey, just remember, Brauns are different. And you know, my last name is Braun. And he would just consistently say, just remember, Brauns are different.
And what did he mean by that?
So he would often have us repeat it back to him. And it surfaced in a lot of different ways throughout our childhood. So in particular, I can remember instances where, you know, let's say another kid around me got something for some reason. If I would bring it up and say, well, you know, he got this or she got that. Most kids had video game consoles, you know,
right.
when we reached a certain age in our house, we didn't have video games. And I would say, why don't we have video games? He would say, Brauns are different. And he would say, we do it this way. But then it really surfaced in forming values. So as an example, if a kid was bullied or someone said something inappropriate to somebody and he found out that one of us didn't stand up for that child, he would, you know, let us know that that was not acceptable. And we would say, well, no one else said anything. And he'd say, Brauns are different. I hold you to a different standard. And so it wasn't to say that we were better or worse. It was just that the expectations of how he and my mother would hold us accountable to operating in the world and, you know, in our little family unit or in our community, in our school, was going to be different. And he also, I think very smartly, you know, often would bring it up when we had a success. And so if we excelled in certain areas, he would say, you know, part of why you did that is because Brauns are different and you're different. And, you know, I've done a lot of, I'll call it sociological kind of research. It's just a big fascination and passion of mine. And I now utilize elements of this with my own children, which is, you know, kids, it's much more powerful to shape identity than to praise action. And so, you know, oftentimes with my older kids, when they started to get into sports, you know, I noticed that my son took a really clear liking to, you know, running around and getting sweaty and all these things. For my daughter, there was some hesitation there. And I said to her at one point, I said, Bela, do you know that you're an athlete? And she said, what do you mean? What's an athlete? And I explained what an athlete was. And I said, are you an athlete? And she said, yeah. And I said, okay, great. And then that idea that she was an athlete was more powerful than saying, oh, you should go do this or you should like that. And so I found in my house, this idea that we were just going to be held to a different standard was really powerful. And then as I asked my dad more recently, you know, what did that really mean? He said, I refuse to accept mediocrity. And I wanted you to feel the same. And so that was kind of the unwritten rule, I would say, of my house, first and foremost. There was no acceptance of mediocrity. If you were going to pursue something, you were going to try and do it with excellence and really profound commitment. And you know, it didn't mean that you had to come in first place every time, but you were going to expect that you were going to achieve something and you're going to put in the work to get there. That was definitely one. The second one, I think, really comes from my mother, whose favorite word is integrity. And it was that the way that you were going to operate in the world and treat others was going to be with respect and kindness and consideration, that you were going to, you know, do your best to live a life of integrity. And so I think, you know, my dad's favorite word is ambition. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, he very much represents that in the life that he lived as, you know,
as do you.
Right. Right. It worked, you know, I think for all of us that grew up, you know, in that house, we try and thread that needle between ambition and integrity and, you know, have tried to live lives of, you know, professional and personal pursuit that demonstrates that.
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, when you're a kid, you're looking to how do I do this life, right? Like how do I do it? And most kids, naturally, what we do is we look around us and we do what they do, right? So it was like your father was programming in your head that other kids can use that playbook, but Bronze are different, that you don't have to. There's actually, you can look to us and we're going to show you the way and it's going to look different. You know, it's like you didn't have to go through that, like, well, they're doing it a different way. What's wrong with me? You went, well, you've already programmed. Oh my gosh, I'm supposed to be doing it a different way. Bronze are different.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple important pieces here that, again, I think are relevant to understand. So first of all, both of my dad's parents are Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. And so they lost their entire families in the concentration camps. They themselves survived through horrific atrocities in the concentration camps and then came to this country on a boat across the Atlantic Ocean when my dad was three. And so he was a refugee in this country and, you know, grew up with a pretty, you know, tough experience and found his way into dentistry and met my mom, whose father died when she was quite young and was raised by primarily a single mother raising three young kids. And so they both experienced, you know, a fair amount of hardship in their lives to get to this point where at the age of four, they could move their family to, you know, a nice suburb that had good public schools, which was Greenwich in Connecticut, as I referenced where I grew up. And so for them, it was also important that we always understood that we shouldn't live a life where we expect things to be handed to us. We had to work tremendously hard. Although at the same time, I recognize we were coming from a foundation of enormous privilege to have, you know, a two-parent household and have access to these great public schools and a supportive family. But there was definitely a sense of responsibility that came with knowing everything that those who had come before us had put in so that we could ideally go out and, you know, create a life of purpose and meaning and, you know, positivity in the world.
Thanks for sharing that, because that gives an entirely different dimension to where Bronze are different is coming from. And also that sense of obligation to give back, which clearly is something that was instilled in you. Talk to me about, like, leaving high school, going into college. Who did you want to be? What did you want to do?
So when I was leaving high school, I very clearly wanted to work in the financial sector. I wanted to work on Wall Street. You know, I, again, grew up about an hour outside of New York City. My dad being a dentist and my mother being an orthodontist. A lot of my friends' parents worked in finance and I had a real penchant for numbers. And I was also really into competitive sports. I played, you know, a lot of sports, but in particular basketball, was recruited to play basketball in undergrad. So I saw this kind of intersection as this idea of trading stocks and took a real fascination with it, got, you know, an internship when I was 16 in the financial sector. And
what? You had an internship at 16?
Yeah, when I was 16.
That's incredible.
I want to say between my sophomore and junior year, I believe. But yeah, I was 16. I interned at a hedge fund. And I can't say I was doing, you know, the most important work for that fund to make the, you know, big decisions they're making. But I was part of, you know, the day-to-day experience and it gave me this fantastic exposure. And so going into college, I was really, really committed to finding my way into that space and hopefully creating a successful career. And then when I was about 21, I saw this film called Baraka that was shot in a bunch of different countries all around the world. And I remember watching this essentially documentary about, you know, different cultures and different experiences globally, and realizing that I had never really left my comfort zone of the Northeast to see these places. And that it was, you know, just this incredibly life-changing experience to watch this film, because I felt this yearning, this calling to go see these places with my own eyes. And that's what drew me to go on semester at sea, which, for those who aren't familiar, it's basically a cruise ship. It has about 1,000 people, oftentimes students, about 650 students from every type of university or college possible. You have community college, you have large public schools, you have private schools. And I just remember thinking, I have to get out of my comfort zone. I have to go see these places with my own eyes. And I've spoken a lot about it since, but I think true self-discovery begins where your comfort zone ends. Mm-hmm. And that was my way of getting out of my comfort zone. And that voyage on semester at sea radically changed my life. And I had a series of quite transformative experiences, but I came back a very, very different person. Mm-hmm. And I was singularly obsessed with trying to create positive impact in the types of communities that I backpacked through on that voyage. And I also just fell in love with backpacking and rural travel. And kind of from 21 onwards, anyone who knew me knew that I wanted to start an organization at that point in my life that would build schools and create positive educational experiences for children in these types of communities, which very much reminded me of my understanding of where my grandparents lived in rural communities. Right. And so it was kind of my way of paying it forward. And that said, I had a mentor who was a really successful CEO and said, I do think that you should get some type of formative training, almost like your version of business school on the job, so that you're not just going out and starting something without some type of really deep understanding of how great organizations are built. And that's what led me, very fortunately, to accept a job offer with Bain & Company in their New York office. And so I ended up working at Bain in their New York office. And that was really the great training ground from which I think a lot of my career has sprung.
We'll have more on this conversation in just a minute. But first, thank you to our sponsors.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by American National, offering a broad suite of insurance solutions to protect what matters most to you.
There's a funny thing about most insurance commercials, whether they feature lizards or birds or funny cartoon characters. It seems like they want you to think about anything but insurance. American National, on the other hand, has real local agents who get to know you, so they can help you reach better decisions about your insurance to make sure you're protecting what matters most to you. American National agents are part of your community. They're your neighbors. So whether it's solutions for your home, your small business, your farm, or your life, you can count on your local American National agent to make sure you get the discounts you deserve and the protection you need without paying for extras you don't. With American National, you get an ally, not just a web page. For a description of the American National companies, the products they write, in the states in which they're licensed, visit americannational.com/dine.
To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by Angostura. If you've ever made a cocktail at home, you've most likely shaken Angostura bitters into your cocktail at the very end of the cocktail making process. In addition to bitters, Angostura has been making world-class rum for more than 130 years. The next fall cocktail you make, try the beautiful, smooth flavor of Angostura rum.
It will transport you to the Caribbean islands of Trinidad and Tobago. The House of Angostura will celebrate its 200-year anniversary of turning drinks into cocktails in 2024. Cheers, everyone. Now back to our conversation.
So when you're at Bain & Company, are you, what was that experience like? And were you, was the concept of Pencils of Promise always in the back of your head at that point?
100% it was in the back of my mind. So, you know, I started working at Bain in 2007, and I had a really, really fantastic, I'll say, set of learnings while I was there. I think Bain's culture is universally recognized as one of the best in the world, and they do a particularly fantastic job of training new employees to get up the curve really quickly. And they give you both a foundational set of hard skills that becomes valuable throughout the rest of your career, but also the soft skills to navigate and understand how to break down complex problems and, you know, interpersonal relationships and company culture and beyond. And so, you know, I was at the bottom of the totem pole, though. I think around then, let's say the company was 3,500 people or something like that. You know, I was what's called an AC1, a first year associate consultant in a class of about 25 in the New York office. And we were all the most junior people at the company.
Right.
And, you know, I've shared this often. I've been employee number one. I've been a CEO now for about 15 years, but I've also been at the very bottom. And I think have a pretty deep understanding and empathy for what it looks like to live in all areas now of a company as I've kind of traveled the professional journey. And I found that I love the people that I worked with. I love the speed of learning, but because I knew that I wanted to build this organization, and it was beyond knowing that I wanted to build, it was really from a place of purpose. I felt like I was on earth to start that organization one day. I was not particularly motivated by the work that we were doing for specific clients that I often didn't control. You know, a staffing manager right. would say, hey, here's the client, here's their needs, you go work on it. I was really interested, again, in the people and the learnings, but the kind of subject matter wasn't what would keep me up late at night, you know, kind of dreaming of the stuff that I dreamed about working on. And as my grandmother, Ma, was turning 80, the Holocaust survivor that I referenced earlier, she was still alive, and I wanted to honor her in her lifetime. And my other grandmother, my grandma Dorothy, also was alive. And I felt like what would be more powerful than living in service of honoring them? And that led me to put $25 in a bank account to start Pencils of Promise in hopes of building one school. And I thought I'd just do it on the side of my job. And Bain lets you leave for 6 to 9 months on what they call their externship opportunity. And I thought, you know, I could get back to this deep sense of purpose. Hopefully I could build one school, and then I'll come back to Bain and maybe I'll go to business school and I'll have this small organization on the side that I'll work on. Put that $25 in that bank account and started working on the organization, and things just took off. And eventually that led me to not only find a way to get that first school crowdsourced through small donations of friends and colleagues and built.
And where was that first school?
So that first school is in Laos. Okay. So in Southeast Asia, one of the most impoverished and least supported countries in the world, but some of the most wonderful, kind people and tremendous, tremendous need, but also tremendous opportunity to, you know, empower that, you know, community in particular, where we started, which was about an hour outside of Luang Prabang in Laos on the rural countryside. And that first school was quite transformative, because once we built one with this community, it was so clear in my mind that there was an opportunity to create an organization that really changed the way that people looked at philanthropy and effective giving, and really brought a lot of the for-profit sensibility and commitment to results that I had been trained on into the nonprofit space that I think has fantastic, you know, ambition and idealism and a sense of contribution to others. And from that point forward, it, you know, things just started to take off.
Yeah, you mentioned that it took off. Why do you think it took off? And was it the strength of the idea, or do you think it was the execution of the school? What was it? Mm. What if you had to pinpoint why it really caught fire, what would you say?
I've always tried to build for where the world is headed, not where it is in this moment. And I think what enabled Pencils of Promise to take off was that we were in a moment culturally where things were shifting really drastically. New technologies were emerging where you could, for the first time, GPS locate and show people exactly what their money went to and where the school was located. social media was relatively new. So I was an undergrad at Brown University in the sophomore class when Mark Zuckerberg started what was the Facebook at the time at Harvard in the sophomore class. And so my friends and I mean, we were first 10 schools to get access to it. And so we were really early adopters. And so we leveraged digital and social in ways that other organizations weren't. And we created a new level of transparency about what your money impacted. And I think the alignment, what I call for purpose, oftentimes of the work, that it's not just about making people feel good, but it's about commitment to impact, that really, really resonated. And I also think, you know, the organization was started in October of 2008. The first $25 went in a bank account. I guess it was, you know, formally incorporated in September. And a few weeks later, a bank account was opened. That was a period of tremendous fear and fracturing in our society. And that recession was just taking off. Lehman Brothers and other companies had imploded. And I find that as much as a lot of people run when there's moments of challenge, it's also this remarkable opportunity to create something that unites people. And I think people were looking to be a part of something bigger than themselves and create a positive impact in the midst of what was a very dark time. And I think all of those together enabled us to really grow at tremendously accelerated rates.
How did you raise the money? You said $25, that's not going to cut it. So how did you start, and what did you learn from that process? Which, whether you're doing something for profit or nonprofit, you got to raise money. You've got to get the funds in.
Yeah. So initially it was actually just events. It was parties. We would say, you know, come and we'll sponsor an event and give $20 at the door. My very first event was my birthday party on Halloween, and it was $20 at the door. And it's a big Halloween gathering. 400 people came and we had $8,000. And then we did another series of events. That's how we funded the first school. It was all donations of less than $100, primarily from people in their early to mid 20s. Over time, as we scaled, because we built such a large digital and social media following, what we believed was that big brands would want to put their dollars aligned to where they could know that the money was going to be used effectively, and they could, you know, reach audiences they were targeting through cross marketing. And so we ended up building really large, significant branded campaigns with some of the biggest brands. Also, you know, celebrities started to really support the organization. And then over time, you know, traditional foundations, high net worth individuals, corporate philanthropy. But at our core, Pencils of Promise has consistently been supported by what I would consider the movement. And that's any individual who can go on the website and create their own campaign.
How many years has Pencils of Promise been in existence now?
So it's been 15 years. We've built over 600 schools around the world with these communities across Laos, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Ghana. Proud to say we have over 250,000 students that we have supported. We've built teacher training programs. It's gone, you know, well beyond just the physical build. So we do water and sanitation and hygiene, latrines, menstrual education, digital, you know, apps for increased readership. Yeah, the organization's rapidly reaching about 1 million community members that we also support, because these schools aren't just the children, it's the full communities.
What is that like for you 15 years after starting it, to see it come to fruition and have such an impact? Like, how does that personally affect you?
Candidly, it's still pretty surreal. You know, numbers are numbers. It's oftentimes the people and the faces and the memories that I have of being with these communities that's quite, I would say, powerful. But, you know, every so often I have these experiences where I'm out somewhere. It happened a few weeks ago. I was at Davos, big World Economic Forum event, and I was actually there speaking about the company that I'm building today, Clarisight. I'm still the chairman of the board at Pencil Promise, so it's still a very meaningful part of my life. But a lot of my professional focus is now on addressing and mitigating climate change and working on sustainability through Clarisight. And I happen to go to a random place to just get a quiet bit of food and met some people that were also at Davos, and we shared a meal together. And at the very end of the meal, we went to exchange LinkedIn contacts, and one of the three individuals looked at my LinkedIn. He goes, "Oh my gosh, Pencils of Promise." I go, "Yeah." He's a German guy. He goes, "I raised $70,000 for Pencils of Promise, and 2,000 people in my community donated. I can't believe it. I went to Laos with, you know, I can't believe your Pencils of Promise. Like, I read your book, Promise of a Pencil." And those moments are actually when it's this really powerful reminder that even though, you know, there's an incredible leadership team, CEO and you know, global staff that drives the organization forward day to day, and that I have a smaller role, but still very meaningful as board chair, that it's still out there doing these great things in the world and that it's having this profound impact on people. It's those moments, I think, that are really things that I cherish.
That's amazing. That's really amazing. Congratulations, and what a moment. Can you explain what you're doing with Clarisight and kind of where your focus is now?
Yeah, absolutely. So probably 4 years ago, I had the good fortune of meeting an individual named Paul Hawken. Paul is one of, if not the most important environmentalist alive today. And my other grandmother, Grandma Dorothy, that I referenced, my mother's mother, she actually started the first recycling center in the state of New York. She wrote a book eventually called Grandma Goes Green. And she was truly one of the OGs of what I think today we call the sustainability broader movement. And so, you know, in my upbringing, which you asked about earlier, you know, the importance of education was always highlighted, but also, you know, care and consideration for this planet and ensuring that we're good stewards for future generations was also really, really important to me. And so as I spent some time with Paul, he really walked me through the science of what we're facing. And the reality is that we will very likely be at a point by 2050 of irreversible change if we don't start making really drastic action happen now. And 2050 for me feels very far off. You know, I'll be an old man at that point, but I learned about this when my older kids were three. And I looked at their timelines and they would be in their mid-30s. And, you know, as a parent, it was a really powerful call to action that I needed to focus my sense of, you know, purpose, much like Pencil of Promise delivered on that. At one point in time, you know, work that I did in higher education also has been quite formative, but that these issues that we face through the lens of climate and sustainability became the paramount issue for me to focus on professionally. And so, you know, as I started to spend more and more time to think about where I and others could create really significant impact, one thing that became quite clear was that the role of large companies was quite outsized. And the impact that you can have by virtue of helping large companies really make good on the commitments that they are providing publicly would be one of the most substantial things you could do. And so, you know, I really believe in advocacy and policy likely being the largest lever, but behind that, the role of enterprise companies is massive. And so with Clarisight, what we do today is we deliver what we call carbon planning and analysis software and associated services to some of the most well-known and recognized and impactful companies on the planet to really help them close the gap between their climate-related intention and action. And, you know, the big goal for us is to enable companies to plan and manage their emissions, much like they do their financials. Because until we have that level of sophistication to be able to really develop the analytics that are predictive so that we know not only our historical data, but have a very clear sense of where we are going based on, you know, business as usual today, and then can develop and cascade plans and goals and targets and then manage our organization towards those targets in the same way that we do so with our, you know, financial and our business objectives. If we can deliver on that same thing for sustainability and climate, then we have an infinitely better chance of actually hitting the targets that we've set. And so that's what we do at Clarisight. And we're, again, really fortunate. We work with some of the largest and most well-known companies in the world.
What do you say to a young person who has a dream of tackling a big problem? You, in your short life, have actually worked on two massive problems globally. One is lack of education and opportunity, and one right now is climate change. These are massive. And for so many people, they're intimidated to think that they could make a dent in them. But we heard at the beginning about what it was like growing up in your household, and we have a glimpse of what might make you different, bronzer different, to tackle that. But I'm just wondering, what would you say to them that maybe didn't have your upbringing? That, because you have actually walked the walk and you show that it is possible. And I'm just wondering what you'd say to them.
Yeah, so I do spend a fair amount of time, you know, with folks that are younger than myself. For a lot of my career, I was always the youngest person in the room. When I started Pencil Promise and we eventually got a full-time staff, I remember one time looking around and thinking, I'm the youngest person on the full-time staff. Now, you know, it's not the case for me as my career has matured. What I would say is, first of all, it's important to have really big dreams. And the absence of a big dream, I think oftentimes is a huge issue for people. You know, there's the sense of, I don't know what I want to do. I know I want to do something, but I'm not really sure. And that's totally okay. But I referenced this earlier. I find that leaving your comfort zone is the surest way to accelerate that process to identify what your big aspirational dream is. You know, I spent a decade plus really focused on building an education. It would have been very comfortable and clear for me to just stay in education for the next, you know, 50 years. And I believe it's remarkably impactful. But by going to different events and putting myself out there and making myself uncomfortable, I ended up having an opportunity at a dinner gathering to meet one of the most seminal climate scientists in the world. And as he spoke to me about this thing that was on my mind, but it wasn't at the forefront of my mind, I felt a sense of purpose around that conversation. And I started obsessing over it and joining random Slack communities and reaching out to people that I didn't know cold and asking if we could chat. And it was that process of discovery that led me to this sense of clarity and purpose that ultimately, you know, created this company, which at its inception was called Climate Club. Now today we call it Clarisite. And then the second thing I would share is it's important to not experience a sense of paralysis because the dream is so big and you don't know where to start.
Right.
So if you look at Pencils of Promise as a parallel, I put $25 in a bank account. That's all I did to start. And I said, come and support my birthday party. I didn't begin by saying I'm going to build 600 schools in 15 years. If someone said to me at the age of 24, 25, you're going to have to go build 600 schools in the next 15 years, I would say, I have no idea how to do that. I have no resources. Like, no way, that's impossible.
Right.
But it was putting one foot in front of another with a small act and then another small act. And then the third thing that I would encourage them to do is to understand that the learnings and the growth comes from the rejection and the failure and the adversity. I think a lot of people, it's when it doesn't work right away that they just kind of give up and they fold and they say, it's not going to happen. And you have to have resiliency. And in some kind of crazy masochistic way, you kind of have to fall in love with the process. You have to fall in love with the journey, knowing that there's going to be both failure and reward. And I can tell you with each of the companies that I've built and, you know, today with the journey at Clarisite, it's really challenging to try and navigate your way into a very large enterprise company. It takes months and months, sometimes years. But I am willing to walk that path because I know that there is it's someone inside of each of these companies, oftentimes many people who deeply care about the role that their company can play and achieving their sustainability targets. And not only that, they know the reality, which is it's coming. As I said earlier, Build for Where the World is headed, not where it is today. It's coming where sustainability will be woven throughout the fabric of every single company. And those that don't anticipate and adapt to that transition and ideally lead will be left behind. And there's a remarkable business opportunity within that piece. And so that's the probably fourth and final thing I would share is, I've learned this certainly the hard way. I'm oftentimes a purist when it comes to the goals and the purpose that I try and work towards in my professional life. You have to meet people where they are and understand that different people have different motivations. And that only really comes from listening. Mm. Listening intensely is a far more valuable skill than speaking immensely. Mm-hmm. And so it's often important when you meet new people or you're going through this process of discovery with others that you ask a lot of thoughtful questions and that you use that information to build a collaborative journey together.
How important was listening and finding people who could help you along the way? Because I'm thinking back to when you had that $25 and you were throwing the birthday party and you're like, okay, got the money, now what, right? Like, I'm sure you leaned on asked for help from so many people and they have helped propel you forward one school at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in the early days of Pencils of Promise, I mean, to build the very first school, I just Google searched for organizations that were working in the countries that I wanted to find a way to build a school. And I didn't say, hey, I'm going to independently go do this by myself. You know, I found a couple They were relatively, I would say, kind of retirees who would build one school a year in the Luang Prabang region of Laos. And they lived in New Jersey. And I said, can I take the train out after work from the Times Square office that I worked out of at Bain at the time? And I'll meet you. And I literally sat with them for 2 or 3 hours. And I just asked them questions about how they did what they did. And that became the basis of a partnership that helped build the very first Pencils of Promise school. They introduced me to the education ministry in Laos and several others. And so that was all about, you know, relationship building. Bain was the very actually first customer of my current company. And that came from reaching out to a senior partner that I knew and just saying, hey, can I, you know, kind of pick your brain? I'm working on this new company focused on sustainability. I'd love your input. And listening to him and him listening to me led to him introducing me to the global CEO of Bain to say, hey, you should chat with him next. And so I think oftentimes it starts with a desire to learn that leads to new opportunities. And you just have to be a kind of voracious learner to generate some of the outcomes that I think many people are seeking.
In a very short amount of time, I feel like you've shared a lot and we've learned a lot from it. Adam, thank you so much for this. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. And how can people find out more about Pencils of Promise?
Sure. So I'll share a couple different resources. So for Pencils of Promise, you can go to pencilsofpromise.org. Have a quite robust website there. If you want to check out Clarisite on the sustainability front, you can go to Clarisite with a C, C-L-A-R-A-S-I-G-H-T.com. And then if you wanted to see any additional information or writing or talks, kind of anything else that I'm putting out there, you can either find me at adambraun.com or LinkedIn is another pretty active place for me these days.
Awesome. Thank you so much. You have a wonderful day and really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Dine For the podcast. For more information on the show, the guests, and the podcast, head to todineforTV.com. You can find us on Instagram at todineforTV and Facebook at todinefor with Kate Sullivan. Thanks to the sponsors of To Dine For the podcast, American National and Terlato Wine Group. Special thank you to producer and sound editor John Golmer. To the loyal followers of this program, cheers, stay hungry, and stay inspired. I'll see you back at the table soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.